Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast, where we have folks of all different walks of life share their trials and tribulations, ideas, cerebral chatter, and experiences. We seek to open minds, shed light, and make our modern world feel a little less lonely, realizing that we are all connected, one human experience at a time. I'm your host, Aisha Billy. I would like to thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm sitting here with Ryan A. Bush, who is an author. His latest book is Become Who You Are, A New Theory of Self-Esteem, Human Greatness, and the Opposite of Depression. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Aisha. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little out of it because I was just in Turkey a week ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I bet you are.
Yeah, but I'm getting back into the grind of things. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. I am really passionate about kind of like your principle of, you know, taking into your hands this organ that we have, right, that controls literally everything. Can you kind of start by maybe talking about your affinity towards this work and what kind of brought you here?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I was, just a teenager, basically, I started becoming more and more fascinated by my own mind and kind of exploring and seeing what I could change in my own mind. Anyone who knows me will tell you that I'm like clueless about my surroundings and I'm not very observant. I don't know directions at all. But I think most of that is because I've been so fascinated with what's going on in my inner world for such a long time. And, I was very curious about changing my own emotions from an early age. You know, I would go through some setback in my life and I would say, like, how can I change things around in my head so that this doesn't bring about this negative, predictable emotion and changes things around into a positive. And I sort of started discovering a lot of these principles and tactics that I would use. And I started planning on coming out with a book with all this. And then at a certain point, I started reading a lot of philosophy and psychology and realized some thinkers had beaten me to it by about 2,000 years and started sharing all these principles too. So I got very into Stoicism and Buddhism and, you know, modern psychology and neuroscience and all this stuff. And I kind of obsessed over it. I've read 500 books on it. And then eventually I had so many notes on the topic that it was like crashing my phone app just to, like, my notes app just to open them. So I decided I needed to write a book. This was when I was working as a product designer. That's what I went to school for. I've worked with a number of startups designing products, physical, digital, even buildings at this point. But I really felt like I needed to get this stuff out there. So I put, I went part-time at my job, took a 60% pay cut so I could spend the rest of my time writing that first book, which ended up being Designing the Mind, The Principles of Psychotecture. It kind of took off. It's done very well. And then I built a community around it called Mindform, a bunch of other products and programs. And now what I think is my best thing I've created yet, which is this new book, Become Who You Are. So I think the first book is, there are people that it's right for and people that it's not who won't like it. It's very much been well received by like software developer types who really like understanding the mechanics of changing your mind and want just like a lot of dense material. It kind of reads like a textbook in some ways. This new one is much more readable and engaging. It's much more personal. It shares a lot more about me. I don't even put my name on the cover of the first book. And this one is like digging into some of my most difficult struggles. But it's also, I think, the most powerful. I think it has the most ability to actually change people's lives. With the last book, I would often tell people, like, yeah, this book is great for like mastering your emotions if you're already in a good place. But if you're struggling, if you're depressed, if you're lost in your life, here are these other books I think you should read. But this one I've built in, you know, pretty much everything that I understand about elevating your overall sense of well-being in your life. And I think it's going to improve a lot of people's lives once it launches.
Yeah. Definitely. There are a few things that I'm buzzing to talk about. I was going to say, talking about depression, what are, and I know that obviously this isn't something that we can just like blanket over or just like hit a gavel and be like, this is what depression is. It's way more of a spectrum than that. And it's not black and white. But how would you define depression?
Yeah, diving in head first here. So I understand depression as a identity failure issue. Essentially, you've gotten to a place where you are not seeing your own greatest strengths. Your self-esteem has gone down as a result, and that has brought about this really negative mood state of low mood, low vitality, low self-regard. I have come around more and more to this as I've been studying it and as I've kind of experienced some episodes of it myself, that this is not some kind of simple, you know, like neurochemical deficiency. It's not just your brain malfunctioning. I think it has much deeper roots than that. I actually think it has a place in our evolutionary origins. And I think it's there specifically to regulate our mood according to what our brain concludes about us. And that can happen for a couple reasons. It can happen, one, because we have a very distorted view of ourselves. I think in the modern world, it's very easy to adopt these distorted beliefs. And this is where cognitive therapy is really useful. But I think it's also possible that we have more or less accurate beliefs about ourselves and that we really aren't living in the way that we would be proud of, in the way that we would admire someone else for. And that's what our brain, I've concluded and I argue in this book, is basically tracking all the time and lifting or lowering our mood accordingly.
Yeah, definitely. I think the tracking is actually pretty helpful, because this is not specific to just mental health. It also works in regards to fat loss, finances. You can't manage what you don't measure. So it's helpful to kind of track and to say, you know, this is obviously like such a layered topic. I just was thinking like about our needs. And I believe that also what can really trigger depression is not having our needs met. And I wonder how many of us actually are in tune with our needs, you know, especially if we were raised in a household where we had to self-abandon a lot for whatever reason. And I know that I'm one of those people who I genuinely didn't know what the fuck my needs were. I come from an immigrant family, actually. So I had to, and I was the oldest, and my parents aren't educated. They don't speak English well. So I had to take on a lot of responsibility from a young age. So I didn't know what my voice was. I didn't know what I was okay with. We were in crisis a lot growing up. So I always had to just like find a way to keep it going. And I believe that that also resulted in depression as well. So when I do what you said and I track it, it helps me recognize, I actually felt good when I was hanging out with X, Y, and Z person in a park. Okay, I might have the need of like spending time with people outside. Like this is something that breathes life into me, et cetera.
Yeah, well, and let me put this forward and see how it maps onto your experience. So what I suggest, there's a very old, kind of outdated sounding word today that's called virtue, which sounds sort of preachy and like moral purity or whatever, but it used to have a much more interesting kind of colorful meaning. And it's essentially this idea that we have these personal strengths that need to find expression. They need to be exercised on a regular basis. And we need to see that we are exercising them. We need to observe that. And so what I find when I look back at my life and the times that I've been really great in terms of my mood and the times that I've been, you know, much less happy, it pretty much perfectly maps onto how well I was capable of bringing out those strengths and those virtues. And some of these are professional. I mean, I'm really big on creativity. I need to have an outlet for that. Some of them are interpersonal. Some of us have strengths like affection and humor, charisma, and those need expression too. And so if we don't have people in our lives that we can bring out those strengths around, or if we don't have an outlet for our, you know, professional virtues, or if we don't have any community in our life, right? This is really what's bringing about the depression. It's specifically a certain kind of need to bring out our greatest strengths and to see them and to feel admiration for ourselves as a result. Because if you're not living in a way that you would admire. And if you aren't seeing evidence of those strengths, then your brain's going to be convinced you don't have them. And so this is the real, you know, the needs that aren't being met in my understanding of depression. It's that need to exercise and to observe your own virtues.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Even like, I studied kinesiology in school, and I remember, you know, depression is also an anatomical term. Like you can describe someone's scapula as being like overly depressed, like overly pushed down, and right, that's an issue. And I guess like, I don't know like the Latin roots of the word, but a lot of anatomical terminology is pulled from Latin. So what I remember learning was it meant like a pushing down, you know, like a repression essentially. And exactly as you said, there are things within us that need to be expressed, and getting clear on that could be the biggest hurdle for some of us.
Oh yeah. It's definitely, it's not just a regular, like being in a bad mood. It feels very different when you're experiencing it than just that. It does push you down. It does make you have no energy. It makes you want to withdraw. It makes you feel just empty essentially, and really bad about yourself. I mean, pretty much invariably, people who are depressed aren't just in a bad mood. They believe, you know, if they're severely depressed, they believe they are, you know, unlovable, incompetent, you know, worthless, essentially. It's brutal, but this is what our brains tell us. And so it's a very unique state that's different from just like being down, right?
Yeah, 100%. Can you get into a little bit of how you would rewire this, the mechanics behind making this better?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are, and this is going to be a very difficult thing to judge when you're in a state like this, but if you are living according to these values and bringing out these virtues, but you have these distorted beliefs and you're not able to see it, everyone around you is, but you somehow have just adopted this view that you're not good at any of these things, right? This is when you really need to do some cognitive restructuring. And so this is a process of basically writing it down anytime you notice you're in a bad mood, and specifically writing down what thought you were having right before you started feeling that, right? What were you thinking about? What belief is behind that when you are feeling that? And if you do this, you'll gradually build up a list of like, these are the types of thoughts I have right before I end up in a bad mood. This is sort of the clue that tells you, okay, these are the beliefs that are actually causing this mood. And this is what cognitive therapy says. It's not just that our moods react directly to the world around us. They respond to our beliefs and our thoughts and interpretations about all that. And so what we have to do is find those distorted beliefs. There are a couple books, you know, I mention all of these in my books, but, you know, Feeling Good, Mind Over Mood, these list, you know, the specific distortions that are very common. There's like 10 of them, like black and white thinking that we fall into in our beliefs about ourselves. And if we can notice, oh, I'm doing this, you know, distorted thought thing, and we can go in and replace it with a healthy, balanced belief, right? If we can find these errors, right, this will gradually work out those mistaken beliefs about ourselves. Now, cognitive therapy doesn't work for everyone. And that's the reason I say there are kind of two ways this could go. Because if your beliefs are that I don't have a life and I never do anything, and you really do just stay home and, you know, sit in bed and play video games all day, you're not going to be able to reason your way out of that belief because it's true. And so the problem with this is that very often depression can be a vicious, you know, cycle where you are sort of trapped, right? You don't have any energy. And as a result, you don't do anything. And as a result, you don't see evidence for your own strengths through your behaviors. And as a result, you're in a bad mood and so on. So it's a cycle. So you have to find the leverage point to work your way out of this cycle. And I think the best way to do this, and this is the other practice that has shown to work really well, better than antidepressant drugs, by the way, is behavioral activation. And it's so stupid simple, I think a lot of people dismiss it, but you basically create an activity schedule where you say, every day I'm going to do this, this, and this. And maybe it's as simple as get out of bed, take a shower, clean up my room a little bit, you know, get to where you're doing that consistently, and then add a little more. I'm going to read a book, I'm going to go on a walk, call a friend, right? These start out really simple. But what happens is you gradually work your way up and demonstrate more and more to yourself what kind of person you are, right? You start going to the gym, you start you know, creating artwork, you are basically showing your brain, look, these are my virtues. This is what I'm good at. And I'm proving it to myself. And then your mood starts lifting and your beliefs about yourself start coming up. And you start gradually working your way up until this vicious cycle becomes a virtuous cycle where it's all feeding into itself and lifting you higher. And so these are basically the two practices that I recommend if you actually are depressed. If you're not depressed, but you're just, you know, trying to get higher, there's some other exercises I would recommend. But if you just do nothing else but these things, it's the best advice I can give for those struggling with it.
Yeah, and it's definitely practical, which I super appreciate that. I was discussing this last night with a friend, how I was saying, like, our brain, and, you know, let me know if you agree with this, but I feel it is so incredibly abstract. Like, when things are going on in it, it's like, you know, trippy. It's like a color and a cloud and like mixed in with like, it's like a fucking like soup tornado situation.
Yeah.
And when we get it out and when we write, you know, this talks more to like anxiety. So let's say you're having anxious thoughts. I know that when I first started vocalizing, because I internalized a lot of my life, like, mm-hmm. you know, talking about it was not a thing that I did until my 20s, I guess. I have a close friend who I was like, you know, I'm feeling very anxious because blah, blah, blah. And he was like, do you hear how incredibly abstract that is? And I thought, yeah. And that just planted a seed to like later on when I would be in therapy and I was vocalizing another anxiety, it would sound something like very ridiculous. Like, if yada yada doesn't work out, I'm going to die. Like that fatalistic mm-hmm. feeling. Meanwhile, that's so not grounded in reality. So I do find that the practical steps of whether it's writing it down or making a schedule is very helpful. I wanted to ask you, where do you feel that, like, as a human, we can't escape negative emotions? Like, I don't feel that we can. This is a part of the human experience. You know, we're not machines. If someone passes away, we'll feel grief. If we get rejected, you know, probably won't be the most positive experience. Where do you feel that this like mechanical structure or like this structure fits in with like not fighting the human experience of just having negative emotions when we do?
Yeah, good question. I like that soup tornado situation. That's a good term for yeah, but it's, you're absolutely right. I think so really what I argue in my first book is something like the opposite view, actually, that we often underestimate how much we can change our emotions and rewire them. I think that you hear a lot that our emotions are kind of there for a reason. They're looking out for us. They're something to listen to. And while I think we absolutely should listen to them and take in all the information we can, ultimately, the reason our emotions are there is because, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, they were good for our ancestors' genes. Not even good for our ancestors, like as human beings. But everything that exists in our mind is there because it was good for our genes. That's what causes it to get preserved and kept around in the next generation. And so we have to keep in mind two important things. One is that our emotions are not necessarily looking out for us. If there's something that we can do that will make us more likely to survive and reproduce, even if it makes us miserable, that's the way our emotions are going to push us toward. But two, we don't live in that same ancient world anymore. A lot has changed. And so our emotions are guiding us in this outdated world. So we didn't have traffic at the time that our emotions evolved. Now we get all this anger that was meant to be there for maybe a time that someone else in our tribe was, you know, causing a barrier for us. But now every day on our commute, we get this anger, and ultimately it's not serving us. It's not really doing anything good. And there's no reason not to try to eliminate it. And we often find when we study emotion regulation, you can eliminate these emotions. And I think, you know, in many cases, it takes, a creative solution for each one to figure out how to do it. But the question I think that gets to the heart of what you're asking is, does this serve me or is it sabotaging me? And is this an emotion that my ideal self, that a person I would admire would experience? And I think that's an important one, because we don't necessarily want to get to a place where we don't feel grief at our own parents' funeral, right? We don't want to become an unfeeling robot, but we want to have the right emotions at the right times. And that's not always the case. So I think asking that question and using it to direct how we shape our emotions and which ones we keep around and which ones we get rid of, I think that's the most important part.
Yeah, like being able to judge what's adaptive and what's maladaptive, for example, right? Like,
exactly.
Yeah. So like, if, for instance, if, you know, you do have a loss that is a big one, let's say, you know, grief and depression kind of swoop you for like 2 months, 3 months. This is specific to me and my, because you know how you said it right now, it kind of puts it in the person's hands to kind of judge whether it is adaptive or not, mm-hmm. or like, you know, within their virtues or not. For me, like I would, it wouldn't mind experiencing that negative feeling for like 2-3 months, for example. But if it was to bleed into like 6 months, a year, like that is maladaptive. Like being stuck and not being able to move on, that is maladaptive. You know, I think the difficult part, and you know, you let me know what you have seen, because you obviously have more data than I do. I think the difficult part is like being able to snap out of it. You know what I mean? When do we snap out of it? When is a good time for us to snap out of it? You know, because mm-hmm. I'm just thinking on grief right now. You know, grief is such an essential part of the process of letting go. And I feel that you have to let go in order to move on, right? So if it's like ABC, when do we know that like it's too far, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough one when it comes to grief. And truthfully, I haven't like explored it all that deeply. You know, I tend to do a deep dive into specific emotions and just read everything there is to know about it. And so I've gone really deep into anxiety. I've gone really deep now into depression. I think grief and loss, this is kind of its own thing, and they can clearly become intertwined. I think, you know, you experience grief just when you experience a loss of something or someone that you really cared about. I think the way that it turns into depression is when that person that you've lost or whatever it is that you've lost represents a, you know, what I call a virtue domain. And so, you know, if you had a person in your life that, you know, they were really your outlet for your sense of humor, for example, they were really your person to bring out these strengths through. Well, yes, you're going to feel grief for a period, but then you'll, you know, then it will stick around until you replace that virtue domain, essentially, until you find someone else that can bring expression to these personal strengths of yours. You might become depressed, or, you know, this can happen if you lose a job too, right? If that job, you know, is very replaceable for you, and you can easily get another one that brings out more, or at least as much of your strengths as the last one did, then you're not going to get stuck in this depression over losing that one job. So really the question is, you know, whether this is going to be this temporary period of grief or whether it's going to really suck out a lot of our opportunities to bring out these strengths and stick around as depression.
I feel attacked. Yeah. No. Sure. I completely agree with that. I lost a person that was kind of like the outlet for my humor and yada, yada, yada. Mm. And it sort of, I mean, this also speaks to trauma, you know, because I don't think it's fair to talk about this stuff without discussing like unprocessed trauma. I had to process that trauma of that like quick loss of like such an intense sense of connection. And you know, it sucks admitting it out loud, but I did acquire maladaptive behaviors from it where I just was like, and, you know, I'm only human, and I do want to say self-compassion is really incredible when it comes to this stuff. I'm a big advocate for self-compassion therapy. So I say this with compassion, but I didn't want to connect. You know what I mean? I was like, I started having thoughts that I haven't had before. Like, what if I get close to somebody else and something happens very quickly? Like, is it even worth it? Like, the pain of that loss was so great that it overshadowed the 7 years that I did have that person in my life. So I do think that, you know, it's super challenging. And I do also feel, looking back at the past 2 years, it's not, I'm not really upset about it, but there are opportunities that I definitely missed out. I definitely kept people at arm's length. That is not how I am. Like, I'm a very much like a, like, I will hug you really close type of person. But I did adapt in that way, you know, and I definitely did miss out on some opportunities. Like, I honestly, I would say, yeah, I did that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry about that loss you experienced. And I think you're right about self-compassion and the importance of that. You know, a lot of people sort of create this false dichotomy between acceptance and compassion and like improvement and betterment. And they say, like, you kind of have to pick one almost. They say, like, oh, you shouldn't try to become more. You should accept yourself exactly as you are. Or, you know, you shouldn't, you know, be too focused on improving your emotions. You should have compassion and accept your emotions. And there's really not this dichotomy. You really don't have to pick one of those two. It's the thing. You absolutely need to accept where you're at. There's no reason to beat yourself up about where you're at. So you need to, you know, be aware of it, embrace it, right? And yes, have compassion for yourself. And you also can set your sights on getting to a better place, getting to where those emotions aren't hurting you on a daily basis, getting to a place where you are capable of aligning with those values more and more, and being more like the, you know, ideal version of you. And so compassion and acceptance, these are like prerequisite steps for moving up the ladder of growth, I think.
Yeah, so, and they are incredible to have. Like, you know, it's, I think this is a Buddhist saying of like, you know, the bad thing that happened is already the first arrow. And then we put a second arrow into ourselves by, you know, judging it or yada, yada, yada. And I find that, like, when you have self-compassion, you remove at least the second arrow. You have one less arrow to deal with. You know, instead of beating ourselves up, we can build ourselves.
Yeah, I love that Buddhist metaphor. And, you know, a few different like schools of thought have said very similar things on that. I think it's absolutely right. You know, very often if you really observe your own pain for just, you know, a few moments without like shielding yourself away from it, if you just look at it and say, what does this actually feel like? Where is it located in my body? What's the actual nature of this pain? You diminish a lot of it, right? A lot of that suffering that you would have experienced, you just get rid of because you're actually accepting and staring right at what you're feeling instead of like denying it, suppressing it, pushing it away. So I think it's very, very effective.
Well, I think that this also talks to like where I feel like my work is headed in life is talking more about like why we have such an aversion towards negative emotions. I think that what we need more collectively is the ability to hold space for that thing or the ability to process that thing rather than like trying to, you know, shove it down and kind of push it away. You know, I think that we do kind of suck as a society, not just in the States. Like I see it in most places that I've traveled where if somebody is upset about something, we try to just like get them to stop as quickly as we can instead of being like, express the feeling, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this actually gets to, you know, we kind of jump straight to depression in terms of like what I'm writing about, but I talk a lot early on in the book about the right way to think about happiness and what it actually means. And that, you know, the idea that we should be, you know, feeling the most positive emotions and no negative emotions, that we should be maximizing pleasure and that'll be the best thing and minimizing pain. I think it's a very distorted, very dangerous idea. So I sort of introduce this like metaphor. If you imagine there's a chessboard in front of you on the table, you know, the x-axis, the left and right, is sort of pleasure and pain. So if you go to the right, that's more pleasure. The left, you're experiencing more pain, you're suffering. And then the y-axis on this chessboard is loss and gain. And so, you know, moving down means you're losing something in your life. You know, going up means you're experiencing some kind of gain or external success. right? And so what I argue is that we basically navigate our lives on this two-dimensional map. We're basically trying to maximize pleasure most of the time, and sometimes we'll sacrifice pleasure in the moment in order to gain something else in our lives in the long term. Well, this basically doesn't map that well onto our actual happiness and what we find. So we'll experience something, you know, people win the lottery and that's the ultimate gain and brings a lot of pleasure, and they still are like, yeah, this doesn't really make me happy. And this is, there's a lot of data behind this. Lottery winners aren't any happier a year later on average than they were before they won. Same for losses. People will lose something and they'll end up saying it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And so how is it that we're using this two-dimensional map and it's leading us astray so often? Well, what I suggest is that we turn this into a three-dimensional map. If you can imagine extruding sort of mountains and valleys out of this chessboard, this is what's actually pulling the strings. This third dimension, this Z-axis, this is what actually gives us a deeper sense of happiness. And sometimes it'll correspond to that pleasure and that gain in our lives, but not always, right? And we'd be wrong to make the pain the enemy when ultimately this is something much deeper than that. And so this third dimension is what I'm calling virtue. You could call it admirability if you want, but it's getting to a place in your life where you're able to admire yourself more and more. That's what causes you to climb the mountain of actual happiness. And the opposite, getting to a place where you don't admire yourself, right? Doing things that cause you not to approve of yourself and your actions and your life. This is how you move down into depression. And ultimately the ancient Greeks, they had this term eudaimonia. And I've argued that basically this ultimate kind of happiness that they were talking about is more or less the opposite clinically of depression, right? It's a state where you have high mood, high vitality, and you highly approve of yourself. And I'm arguing that this is the real dimension we should all be paying attention to. You know, if we have to experience some pain in the short run in order to climb higher up this mountain, then we should, because this is what actually makes us deeply fulfilled, right? Other times, you know, there will be opportunities to gain something and also move up in this direction. But I think we should always be asking this question if we're thinking about a job change or trying to decide what I should do in my relationships, right? Asking yourself, what will move me up in these mountains of virtue? What will give me a greater opportunity to bring out these strengths and exercise them on a regular basis? It's much more important than a small, you know, difference in salary or something if you're making a change in your life.
Yeah, I really fucking love that. Because, like, exactly as you said, it brings it from 2D to 3D. And, like, I mean, we live in a 3D dimension. But anyway, that's really fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. I wanted to ask you if you would agree with this. Like, so it's not about getting to a place where you just don't feel negative emotions at all. Is it more about what you're saying, getting to a place where there is enough fulfillment and enough self-esteem so that whenever X, Y, and Z thing does arise, you're able to cope with it in a way that doesn't completely tank you or doesn't completely make you avert from your virtues?
Yeah. I mean, there are people who have gone through such unimaginably difficult circumstances. I mean, I recently reread Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. He was in a concentration camp. And he even found a way to find life meaningful and to find a kind of fulfillment in basically torturous situations where he is experiencing a lot of negative emotions, but he didn't compromise his dignity in a way that caused him to adopt this, you know, repulsive view of himself. And that is not something everyone can say. Some people, in order to avoid negative emotions or pain, they will compromise their own values in their lives. And that's when you actually do hurt your deeper, you know, happiness. It's when you do compromise the things you value in order to achieve something more superficial, gain success, pleasure.
Yeah. Or becoming numb. I just think about numbing a lot. And I know for me, like that was a very adaptive behavior for me when I was younger. Just emotional numbing, not using substance too, but which I know is also very common. But I would just, without it was a reaction. I wouldn't think about it. I would just, numbing was a thing that would just happen in order, looking back, in order for me to function in my day to day. Where I'm an adult now, I'm not in that environment anymore, and numbing is maladaptive for me now. And I don't want to, I really don't want to be a fucking numb adult. Like, I personally do want to feel the pain. I do want to feel the happiness or the joy and whatever other feelings that we can experience as humans. Like, I want to wring out my human experience by the time I'm dead. I don't want to go back in the coffin all cute and pretty. Like, I want scars. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I do think also, like, I want to do as you said without, for me, going into like a really numb state of, you know, never wanting to experience like the bad feelings and stuff like that. So I just think that that mountain, that 3D map is, it's such a good analogy because it shows you that, you know, it really does tie down to like fulfillment, I feel like, ultimately.
Yeah, no, I think the numbing thing very likely is a natural coping mechanism that has its place when you're going through something really shocking and difficult. But I do think you want to get to where you are experiencing emotions more deeply and allowing yourself to, and not pushing them out. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Are you open to talking about just a little bit more personal? What was the inspiration for you to dive down this work?
Yeah. So for the first part, I will say that I've been studying all these sort of puzzle pieces for over a decade now. I've been trying to piece together everything I know about happiness and depression and self-esteem and all these different ideas. I've been studying a lot of data, and I never have really been able to click it all into place to where it all makes sort of sense in a coherent way. And I think it took kind of experiencing it myself, going through an episode of depression myself, to really bring this home for me. And so several years ago, when I was writing my first book, actually, I started going through kind of a mental health struggle myself, which is always ironic when you're writing a book trying to teach people how to not have that happen. But it's actually more common than you would think. And so I was, like
sense.
I said,
it probably brought up stuff for you, you know?
It brings up stuff, and it's also like, it's really difficult. And so you have to make sacrifices, and you lose sight of some of the things that matter in your life when you're trying to, you know, get this masterpiece out there. And so, you know, I told you I was part-time at my job. You know, I was becoming sort of more and more alienated from my work there. I had fallen into a role that was very different than what I started out doing. So I was doing really boring, like, engineering drawings, and I was really not good at it. And, you know, I had started out doing all this creative vision product design stuff that was bringing out my virtues. And now here I was just doing these, you know, these tasks that I was pretty bad at and not really bringing out evidence of the things I'm actually really good at. I had a kind of conflict that escalated with a coworker as well, where she just clearly did not like anything about me from the start. I mean, it was visceral, and I know that'll just happen sometimes, but it was the first time I had experienced it to this level. There was nothing I could do to like fix it. And at one point she even diagnosed me unsolicitedly with autism, and that sent me down a whole spiral questioning my own, you know, mental state and dealing with what is apparently like a developmental disorder. And of course I was trying to get this book out. So I had shut down a lot of other avenues in my life. And then there was a global pandemic, as we all know, and that doesn't tend to help things when you're struggling. So
it helps, you know, alcohol sales.
Yes, it does. It helps. It helps the sales of a lot of things, actually. A lot of people did very well in that sense in the pandemic. But no, I mean, cutting off all of these parts of your life that previously you were involved in, and not having access to those relationships and communities, that doesn't help. So I say in the book, I kind of fell into the valleys of virtue. I was no longer seeing evidence of the great person that I was for that period of time of, you know, maybe 9 months to a year. And my self-esteem kind of went down to, you know, a lower level than it ever had been in my life. And like clockwork, I started getting these symptoms of depression that I had also never experienced before. I really wasn't proud of the person I was all of a sudden. I had this awful like feeling in my gut, like I was just ashamed of myself. And I, you know, kind of quit being interested in my hobbies. I quit playing piano. I quit reading. I was still struggling to make it and to stay, you know, relevant to my job and also to get this book out and everything. And thankfully, I had a very, you know, happy, healthy relationship that I'm still with. And that was, in many ways, I think what saved it from getting a lot worse. But essentially, yeah, I had this experience of observing, oh, look, this is what happens when your view of yourself goes down below a certain point. It's been compared to a like fuel gauge in your car. You know, your brain is trying to optimize for social standing and social esteem. And the reason I think we have self-esteem in the first place is like that fuel gauge. If social esteem is the tank in the car, you know, self-esteem is that fuel gauge that tells us how we're doing. And when it gets to a low point, depression is essentially that little light that turns on that tells you there's a problem. And so it kind of took a lot of restructuring in my life to get to a place where I was once again feeling proud of who I was and deeply fulfilled. You know, I had some very helpful things happen. I got out of that job where I was being kind of antagonized by a coworker. I got to a place where my work was really being appreciated on a regular basis for the creativity and the analytical abilities that I pride myself on. You know, I finally got that book out there. And I think, you know, regardless of how well the book did, I think just having it done and out there would have been a very good thing. But it also basically opened this whole world for me to create this world of psychotecture, right? That's the term that I use in my first book. And I built a community and I created a, you know, audience to the point where this is what I do now. And I have this opportunity to bring out like my seven different strengths from all these different places and put them in one place. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And so again, I frame it in terms of these virtues. I don't think I was seeing my virtues during that period that I was depressed. And now I'm able to bring them out on a daily basis more than I ever have in my life. And I'm in a very good place as a result.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. Cause it's always so nice to hear, not just nice, it's critical to hear, the part where the creator was in the lab, not the how they're doing after all the sales and after all the yada yada. It's the stuff that we did not see, the blood, sweat, and tears that were put into this, you know, because it's so easy for us, especially when we see somebody who has had the success that you have had, to be like, oh my God, like, fuck, like maybe it just happened overnight or yada yada, where, you know, it came at a fucking cost, you know, like that experience that you expressed, not easy, you know. So I really appreciate you opening up and sharing about that. And I also want to say I super appreciate your ability to take yourself out of yourself and kind of remove bias, which I think is super hard to do as a human, and try to look at things from that bird's eye view in terms of analytics. Because what can happen from my experience when feelings get involved, especially if it's like just a super internal experience, it can become that soup tornado shithole that kind of just keeps drowning you, where you are able to say, okay, like trigger number one, for instance, was this job for you, and that you knew you had to pivot out of there. And that was obviously very alleviating for you, you know, where I wonder if somebody who, you know, isn't as good at taking themselves out would maybe just stay in the job because they're not conscious to the effect that it's having on them.
Yeah. So that gets a lot of good things. One of the things is that, one of the best ways to get rid of depression, it's found, is to get out of the situation that is depressing you. If you happen to know what that is, and it's not always the case, very often escaping that place and getting somewhere else will, you know, almost magically transform things for you. And And I think that all maps on very well to the framework that I've laid out here. But I'll also say, I think you're right that if I didn't have the perspective and a lot of these coping skills that I was writing about and that I had acquired over the years, it could have been a lot worse, right? I think this is why I didn't get severely depressed and it was relatively mild, because I did have the perspective to say, okay, I've sort of fallen into these distorted beliefs about myself. On some level, I know they're distorted. I know this is not really true. I will say that you know, reasoning with yourself is not as powerful as proving it to yourself. And so actually doing the thing in your life that you want to believe about yourself is a much more effective, ultimately easier way than to just tell yourself, no, that's not really true. That's not me. This is temporary, whatever. So actually getting out there and proving it. But I agree, it's important to share this, you know, these struggles. And I like how you called it the lab too, because I have thought about that period as sort of an experiment that I went through and I learned a ton. I mean, it's what created this new book. That's how much it clicked into place for me. I needed to have an experience like that, I think, to be able to piece all these different things together and see how they all connect.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think I have been thinking more about patience lately. And how, you know, because like I can tend to be impatient naturally. I'm sure many of us listening are as well, can be. And I would think like it's nice that you had the patience, you know, whether it was a conscious thing or not, to kind of write out that lab period, because there was clearly a purpose for it that you didn't see right away. Maybe you saw years later, you know what I mean? And I always remind myself that, especially when I want the instant gratification rather than delayed, I say, you know, give it time. Like, seriously, just give it time, because the lead might alchemize into gold, you know, as some people say.
Yeah, patience is very important. And it's difficult, because I don't think this has to be the case, but it's very tempting to equate emotional patience with like behavioral patience. And what I mean is, ideally, you want to be in a place where you're very patient emotionally and you're not struggling and beating your head against the wall because things aren't happening fast enough. But you also, in your behaviors and the way you're running your work, your life, your business, whatever it is, you want to have a certain kind of impatience and you want to be pushing really hard. And so maintaining that persistence and that drive to get things done without letting it infect your emotions, without getting to a place where you're straining over it, I think that's a really delicate balance, but I think it can be done.
Yeah, I completely agree. To me, that falls under the self-mastery. Like, that is like a serious big game fucking ability that you were just saying. Mm-hmm. You are the founder of Design Your Mind.
Designing the Mind.
Designing the Mind. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is what sort of emerged out of that first book. Once I got the first book out there and got myself to a better position in general, I did not waste time in creating a lot of other stuff. I mean, the book brought in a lot of people to my sort of email list, and I started creating new products and programs and this community. And so I built like this deck of introspection cards called Mindsight, because I think we have a introspective deficiency in our culture. Most of us aren't asking ourselves the questions we need to be. So this gives you like a card a day that you go on a walk, write down in a little pocket-sized journal, answers to these questions, has you kind of develop self-knowledge. I created a, you know, very nice sort of hardcover version of the first book. And then I created a couple of programs. The Anxiety Algorithm is a book length, like 30-day program. And the Flourishing Function is kind of a similar program, but based on these ideas about depression and well-being in this book. And of course, I wrote this book and I created a online community, soon to be not just online, I think, but right now it's a place for people who are interested in psychotecture and in changing and redesigning their minds to meet and connect. And all the programs and everything are here. I'm writing a lot on Mindform as well. So it's kind of kind of built this little world centered around everything that I'm interested in. It's very cool.
Super cool. I'm really happy for you. You did what one may call the impossible, but it's a big deal, you know, being able to create all of this. We are near the end of the podcast. If anybody would like to connect with you or maybe kind of look into like the other books that you have, where can we find you?
Yeah. So the best place to go is designingthemind.org/becoming. I will send you a couple of free books, including the Psychotext Toolkit and the Book of Self-Mastery. You just mentioned self-mastery. And so this is kind of a quote compilation and commentary book. I sometimes forget about when I mention all the things I've been making because we've been very busy. But really good stuff that you can get for free by hopping on the email list there. You'll also know when this new book is out. I'm actually planning on opening up pre-orders any day now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that. So be sure to check. We're trying to do a big kind of pre-order launch with this one. And I think you guys are going to love it. I've been kind of holding on to it and tweaking and refining it for a while now. So I'm really excited to finally share it with everyone.
Super cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing. And I'm personally very appreciative of the work that you are putting out into the world. So I just want to thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And that's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you for tuning in. Please share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating if you gain anything at all from today's podcast. And we look forward to having you back next.